Hi, this is Barry List at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Why do American college basketball fans go crazy every spring? And what insights can operations researchers who specialize in sports give to fans who want to test their predictions or place high in their office pools? In today's segment, we talk to Joel Sokol of the Georgia Institute of Technology and Sheldon Jacobson of the University of Illinois. Both professors have applied scientific precision to analyzing March Madness. Professor Sokol, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thanks.
And Professor Jacobson, welcome.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Maybe we can start with an overview for non-fans like me who may have to switch to basketball if the NFL and NHL go on strike. Professor Sokol, I'll ask you first, how are the best 68 men's college basketball teams picked, and how are they weaned down to the Sweet 16 and the Final Four?
About half of them, 32, automatically get selected for the tournament by winning their conference tournaments. And then the other 36 are chosen by a committee that's appointed by the NCAA that looks at things like how many games they've won and lost, who they've beaten, who they've lost to, whether games were at home, on the road, that kind of thing, and also uses their own subjective judgment and basketball knowledge to try to pick the best remaining 36 teams. Once those teams are selected, they play a six-round single elimination tournament with a few preliminary games to get down to 64, and the winner of that 64-team single elimination tournament is the national champion.
And what exactly is seeding? How does that work?
After the teams are selected, the NCAA committee essentially ranks them from 1 to 68 and then splits them into four regions. In each of the four regions, the teams are ranked again from 1 to 16 or 1 to 17 and seeded into a single elimination tournament. Ideally, they try to have what's called an S-curve, where the first region gets the best team, the second region gets the second best team, the third gets the third best team, the fourth gets the fourth best team, and then they go backwards, fourth, third, second, first, on down. But they do make a few changes so that teams don't play on their own home court, for example, in preliminary rounds. And so teams don't play conference rivals too early in the tournament.
A lot of the excitement comes when there are upsets and the best teams in the country are unexpectedly defeated. What fraction of NCAA games are upsets?
About a quarter of NCAA tournament games are upsets. And we define upset to mean that the better team has lost, even if they're not the better seed. Sometimes it turns out that the team that's seeded higher is actually worse than the team they're playing. And so other definitions of upsets would take that into account. But either way, it's about a quarter of all games.
Professor Jacobson, you wrote an article for the INFORMS magazine ORMS today called Analytics of Bracketology. It gives a good sense of how a mathematician approaches the probability of any team winning and the probability of lower-seeded teams upsetting higher-seeded teams. How does it work, and how did all this play out last year?
Well, last year was a very interesting year because some of the traditional powerhouses like North Carolina, UCLA, Indiana, and Arizona, which have won national championships, they did not make the tournament. Although this year in 2011, it does appear that three of those four, North Carolina, UCLA, and Arizona, will be in the tournament. The committee does a job using, as Joel had said, basic criteria. And by using these criteria consistently, what we've been able to observe is that there are trends in how the seeds perform in the tournament year in and year out. The tournament, in many ways, is a candy store of excitement for any of the analytically inclined people. And that's what we found using operations research and mathematical tools, that we can see trends in what happens. We've actually incorporated these trends into a website, bracketodds.cs.illinois.edu, where people compute the likelihood of any combination of seeds occurring in different rounds.
And we'll have that URL on our website so people can check it out, and also Professor Sokol's URL. We're talking on March 8th, several days before this year's 68 teams are announced. How will you begin your analysis once we know the teams?
Well, what we do is we look at the seeds. The committee does an interesting job because of the consistency in which they use their criteria in setting the seeds. And this consistency can translate into mathematical models. So as a result, what we start to do as the bracket begins to form in terms of the 16 seeds in the four different regions plus the four other teams that have been added in more recently, is we start to look at the trends. And what we start noticing is that, as Joel had said, there are a tremendous amount of upsets which occur with great predictability. For example, if we look in the Sweet 16, which is a round that people often look at after the first round, in 22 of the last 26 years, there have been one or more teams seeded 11 to 16 which have been in that tournament round. And that just shows you that even though they are very unlikely to reach it, they do reach it very consistently.
Is there any attempt on the part of those doing the seeding to make basketball more interesting by hoping that there will be these upsets? Or is it just hope?
The upsets occur with great frequency and predictability. The difficulty is determining exactly which one will occur at any given time. I mean, for example, if we take teams which are seeded 7 to 10, which by any measure should not reach the seed 16, they in fact occur on average, 1 to 2 teams every year being of that ranking in the Sweet 16. In fact, we've had two or more of those teams seeded in 18 of the last 26 years, which is quite amazing. Yet, it's very predictable because upsets occur with great predictability, as Joel had said.
How will the expansion this year from 65 to 68 teams affect both your calculations and the way the playoffs unfold?
Well, since these extra teams have been added into what are now referred to as the first four, once those games have been played, we basically come back down to the 64-team structure of the bracket. So I don't anticipate it making a difference, although over time we'll be able to collect the data and see if it did make a difference. But at this point, I don't anticipate any real impact.
Why was it expanded?
It was expanded for a variety of reasons. There's pressure on teams who are consistently on the bubble, who don't seem to be able to make the tournament year in and year out, who want more slots. There's an argument that we want more mid-majors or low-majors to give them a chance to be able to be in the tournament. There's a lot of discussion around this issue. There's even a discussion that possibly the tournament could expand to 96 teams. I'm not sure where we're going to be heading with this, but ultimately, when there are more teams in the tournament, the laws of probability say there's a greater chance that more of them will have upsets. And we will see that this year potentially in the first four. Maybe one or two of the teams which we expect to win will actually end up losing. And then we'll see how that propagates through the rest of the bracket.
Professor Sokol, you worked on a system called LRMC. What is that and how good is it at making predictions?
Like Sheldon said, it's difficult to predict when upsets are going to occur specifically, but LRMC has been more likely to pick out those upsets and pick out the correct winner of more tournament games than most other methods out there. Last year, we tracked against more than 50 different ranking systems, and LRMC predicted the outcome of more tournament games than any of them. A few years ago, 2008, it predicted, before the tournament started, the winners of every game in the last three rounds of the tournament, the final four, the final two, the winner. So it's had some big successes. Of course, there is so much uncertainty, and so many of the games come down to whether a last-second shot will rattle in or rim out, that it's impossible to guarantee success over the short run. But over the long run, it seems to have performed very well.
I get a sense that among reporters there's a certain glee when a computer or a program has been defeated, showing that there's still some kind of humanity involved.
That's true, and I guess we saw it just recently seeing IBM's Watson on Jeopardy, where it pretty soundly defeated two excellent human competitors, but a lot of the focus was on the one or two stupid answers that it gave instead of all the correct answers that it gave. And we've seen the same sort of thing, that there's focus on the one or two stupid things sometimes that our model says, but also the bottom line success people seem to be noticing and appreciating.
And remind me, what are the initials LRMC, what do they stand for?
So LRMC stands for Logistic Regression Markov Chain, which are the two mathematical modeling techniques that we use to put this model together. More recently, we've introduced a Bayesian probabilistic approach as well, but we thought we had enough initials already.
Do you want to explain a little bit? Bayesian theory has a little bit of knowledge among the public. Perhaps you'd like to say a short definition.
Sure. Bayesian probability, instead of trying to find a specific parameter value that you think is known, we essentially make an assumption beforehand about how good teams are in general, and then use the results of all the games that have been played so far during the college basketball season to refine that assumption and update our probabilistic information about which teams are better than others.
And what aspects of teams' performance do you concentrate on?
So we concentrate only on things that are available easily in basic scoreboard data. So the kind of things that you could see if you go to the Daily Yahoo scoreboard or ESPN scoreboard or wherever you happen to go. We look at, for every game that's played in Division I college basketball, the two teams playing, where the game was played, whether it was at one team's home court, the other team's home court, or a neutral site, and what the margin of victory was between the two teams.
So a pretty broad spectrum of data being analyzed. When you were interviewed by CNN in 2009, you traced the formulation of LRMC to your frustration with the way Georgia Tech's team was passed over by the committee setting up the dance card. What happened?
A number of years ago, Georgia Tech was playing in a mid-season, early season holiday tournament. They were ahead by 2 points against, I think it was Tennessee, with just a couple seconds left. And one of the players from Tennessee threw up a half-court shot that almost never goes in, but this one happened to go in, and Tennessee won by a point. And then at the
painful
end of the year, yeah, well, for Georgia Tech fans at least, I imagine people north of us were a little happier.
Right.
But at the end of the year, a lot of the pundits were saying Georgia Tech might have been considered for the tournament if they had just won one more game. And so it seemed a little bit ridiculous that whether or not this lucky shot had gone in at the end of a game somehow made the difference in people's minds about whether Georgia Tech was good enough or not good enough to be in the tournament. And so we sat down and said, you know, I bet that operations research could give us a better way of doing this. Let's see what we can come up with.
And now let's turn to the fan side of things and the way fans can participate and not just watch. What are the different kinds of office pools in which people bet on the outcomes of the NCAA tournament? And I don't know, perhaps Professor Jacobson, you'd like to chime in.
Well, there are different types of pools. Some of them simply count the number of correct winners that they have. Other pools, in fact, use more sophisticated counting processes so that upsets are weighted more heavily while favorites are weighted less heavily, and as a result, people who are able to predict the upsets are given more weight and bonus. Ultimately, to create a good bracket, one wants to first determine who your national champion is going to be, then your national finalists, and work backwards. A mistake that many people make is that they fall in love with a Cinderella, and they think the Cinderella will proceed through the tournament, and we will see another George Mason, where we had an 11 seed going as far as the Final Four. This does happen on occasion, but it just doesn't happen often enough to justify having such a upset occurring with such depth into the tournament.
So it's exciting, but don't count on it.
Exactly, and I think many of us kind of hope to see it, but ultimately, if you look at the trends of the winners, seeds 1, 2, and 3 tend to be the dominant teams who win the national championship year in and year out. And the statistics continue to bear that out. In fact, if you look over the last 26 years, 23 of them have been seeded either 1, 2, or 3.
And if I want a reasonable chance of making some money in my office pool, or at least not getting embarrassed, how do I come up with a strategy?
Well, one of the things you can do is early in the tournament, you will see some upsets, and that's where you want to put your upsets, where an 11 will end up defeating a 6, or 12s and 5s are often very common upsets. We tend to see, you know, 1 to 2 of those every year on average. Occasionally, you'll see a 13 or a 14. We're long overdue for a 15 beating a 2. We almost had that last year with Robert Morris and Villanova. These are things that you want to have early in the tournament. But ultimately, once you get to the Elite Eight and beyond, you start to focus on the top 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 seeds. And that's where you want to put your emphasis.
If it's not too early in the process, maybe we can get down to the nitty-gritty. What teams do each of you have your eyes on this early in the playoffs, both in terms of the likely higher-seeded teams and those that you think are overlooked? And Professor Sokol, why don't you take the first crack?
Our model has been pretty robust in that the top three, almost since January, in some order, varying depending on recent success, have been Ohio State, Kansas, and Duke. So those seem to be the three teams that our model has picked out as the strongest in the country. Of course, that's not so surprising to anyone who's followed college basketball this year. Maybe a dark horse candidate would be a team like a Belmont, who's out of the Atlantic Sun Conference, not a conference people see very much, watch very much, but they've performed very well. Our model thinks they're also a very good team. When they've had a chance to play tougher competition, they've actually shown up very well. They have three single-digit losses, all to one of the top few teams in the SEC, twice to Tennessee, once to Vanderbilt. And so I think they're a team that could be more dangerous than people think once the tournament starts.
Anything to add to that, Professor Jacobson?
Well, we don't focus on the specific teams. We just focus on the seeds. And people like to think, if you look at the pundits, that the ones are going to advance to the Final Four. But statistically speaking, the most common set of Final Four seeds are 2 ones, a 2, and a 3. And that means 2 of the ones have to lose. The question is, who will they be and when will that occur? Even though I'm at a school which is in the Big Ten, I just don't think Ohio State is going to be able to last it out to the very end. And if I had to choose a couple of teams which look interesting, I would say a team like Utah State, which has a very good record and strong defense, is a team that may end up surprising some people. Is there any basis for that? Just a gut feeling.
Not to get too technical, but how do each of you test and improve your systems, your algorithms? And Professor Jacobson, why don't you just continue?
Sure. What we do is we take the data that's available and we do a lot of statistical analysis to match our model to what is happening. And when it doesn't fit well, we try and make some kind of adjustments in the parameters to see if we can make it work well. In some cases, like in the first 2 rounds, the model just doesn't work, while in the last 4 rounds, it works extremely well. So it's basically using the data, using analytical methods and procedures, and refining it to produce the results that will be useful, insightful, and helpful to bracketologists.
Professor Sokol?
So our overall strategy is actually pretty similar. We start out, everything is data-driven. So we start out with the data we've got and try to form a mathematical model that explains it and is good at predicting what might happen in the future. We actually test also on past data. So we can go back more than 10 years now and test if we wanted to make a certain tweak in our algorithm, how well would it have done over the past 10 or 11 years, and see if it really is an improvement or if it's not an improvement.
We only have time for one or two more questions. How do you think some of the legendary teams like Duke or North Carolina and UConn will do this year, Professor Sokol?
Like I said, Duke has been one of the top few teams in our algorithms rankings pretty much every day since early January. North Carolina has also climbed up into the top 20. And Connecticut is ranked less highly than that, but still a pretty strong tournament team. But, of course, since upsets are so common, it's difficult to say with any certainty how far any of them will go. But I think in that order, that's sort of the order of success priority that I would assign.
Final question for each of you. I imagine there are a lot of students of math and operations research who are sports fans. How do you teach sports in the classroom? And why don't we start with Professor Jacobson?
Well, what I do is I talk about what we do with our students, and especially in my stochastic processes or applied probability class, and then what I'm able to do is show them the models. And since they're interested in the sports, I then open up the hood of the model and show them what's going on underneath, and they can see how the very methodologies and tools that they're learning in the classroom can actually do something which is very predictive in something that excites them. So that's how I try and do it.
And Professor Sokol?
So that's pretty much what we do at Georgia Tech also. We use the sports application to get everybody interested, then go back and show the math. And the sports application really helps a lot, too, in describing how the math works in simpler terms than just equations and notation on the blackboard. It's a lot easier, for example, to explain how a Markov chain works if you have examples of basketball teams beating each other and losing to each other than it is if it's just sort of a bland equation on the blackboard.
And do you see a future Bill James coming up among the young people that you're teaching?
That would be nice.
We can only hope.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Joel Sokol of Georgia Tech and Sheldon Jacobson of the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and this series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.